Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Congestion pricing is dead. Now what? Remember all those arguments about how needed it was for mass transit, big business, and public health? Will Sheldon Silver or anyone else come up with an alternative? Will the Second Avenue subway and other MTA capital projects die along with the $8 fee? What will happen to Mayor Bloomberg now that he alienated much of the city council and state legislature on the issue amid speculation that he was thinking of running for governor? Let's talk policy and politics with Washington Post columnist and editorial board member Jonathan Capehart. A little full disclosure here. He did work for the Bloomberg administration in its first term. And also with us is Catherine Wild, who is president and CEO of the Partnership for New York City, the business group that was much in support of congestion pricing. Welcome back to WNYC, both of you. Good morning.
Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
First, Catherine, how dead is congestion pricing? Is it really most sincerely dead, or can it rise again in some other way soon?
Well, I think congestion pricing was a long shot in the year of a legislative election, and so we knew this was going to be tough, but it seemed like the important thing to do to move this along begin to deal with the problems both of traffic and the environment, the business costs that are raised by congestion. And I think we got the conversation going this year. I think it's far from dead. I believe this is going to be an ongoing conversation. Every day, another world city is moving forward with a congestion pricing plan. There are 28 cities across America that are lined up for the federal money that we won't get. So I think this is an idea whose time has come. It hasn't quite reached Albany yet.
Jonathan, you agree?
I do agree. I mean, this is a conversation that has to be ongoing. It's about the future of the city. I mean, remember when this was first broached, I do believe, Kathy, tell me if I'm wrong, when congestion pricing was first broached, Mayor Bloomberg was against it. He did not think it was a good idea. He threw cold water on it, and I think through concerted effort by environmental groups, by even some of his own aides, he turned around. And, you know, you've got a city of 8 million people that's going to keep growing, that is a magnet for people from around the world. There's just no way that the current infrastructure in the city is going to keep up with that amount of growth. And at some point, Albany, and in particular, Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, will have to get on board with a program of some sort to deal with this. You know, Speaker Silver has said no continuously for at least a decade to many or quite a few big projects for New York City, but has never come up with a plan of his own. And I think congestion pricing or something very similar to it will have to be instituted, and it would be a great idea if Speaker Silver would get away from saying no and actually presenting real positive plans that people can pick apart. The same way they picked apart the congestion pricing plan that Mayor Bloomberg and others put forward.
Yeah, the same way they picked apart, that others can pick his plan apart.
Yeah,
but do you
plan.
Think this is really a Shelley Silver issue? And I want to ask both of you. I know we're hearing things like you just said from a lot of supporters of the plan today, but, you know, wasn't this almost the opposite of the usual three men in a room Albany politics, where Sheldon Silver was pretty much left with no choice because of the fierce opposition of his rank and file? And no matter what compromise Mayor Bloomberg came up with, it wasn't enough. It wasn't what the members wanted. We had Deborah Glick from Lower Manhattan on yesterday, who's a legislator who, from within the congestion pricing zone, who you know, I think could have been a potential supporter. And she mentioned a couple of environmental things for her district that she would have wanted, and the mayor never came through. But didn't this bubble up, Catherine, from the widespread opposition of downstate assembly members, rather than Sheldon Silver coming back from back room, coming in from back room, where, you know, where Joe Bruno wanted it and David Patterson wanted it, and saying no on his own?
Well, I'm Jonathan, not I, is the political expert, so I'll let him come in on the politics. I did wander the halls of Albany for the past few months, however, speaking with legislators, and I think it is very fair to say that the decision not to support congestion pricing was one that bubbled up from legislators who felt, in some cases, had legitimate issues about transportation improvements they felt they needed in their district that they had been looking for from the MTA for years. This was their shot to get them. They didn't feel that they received them. So they felt that there was no quid pro quo. There was nothing to go back to their district with to say you've got a positive improvement. And I think that was a major
mm-hmm.
issue.
Right.
And then, as I say, it's an election year.
So, yeah. Jonathan, how much is it really Sheldon Silver, and how much is it really everybody?
It's a mixture of both, but Sheldon Silver leads the chamber. Sheldon Silver is the speaker. Sheldon Silver has a supermajority in the assembly. And the fact that the congestion pricing issue didn't even come up for a vote. They just let it expire. That's not leadership. And we would be able to have a real conversation about just how much opposition there was for real to the congestion pricing plan if there had been a vote. You know, why not let it come up for a vote? And if Mayor Bloomberg is to be defeated, have him be defeated fairly and squarely by showing, you know, it being knocked out of the park with opposition from 100 members of the assembly, then we would have a clear indication that the congestion pricing plan had no support and was DOA.
But isn't the problem really in the other direction? I mean, that people were unwilling to go on the record in support of it because it's an election year, as Catherine says. Is there really such fear on the part of the legislators to stand up and say they were against congestion pricing? I had legislators lining up to come on this show to talk against congestion pricing. Much more difficult to find somebody to talk publicly for it.
So, I mean, I just wonder why legislators didn't push the speaker to have a vote so that they could go on record publicly as being against congestion pricing for the precise reason that you state. They are up for re-election, and I think a lot of the incumbents don't have much to worry about since Albany has the highest re-election rate in the country. So
I think it's a problem more of omission than commission here in terms of the leadership. In cities around the world, every time congestion pricing has been raised, usually coming out of the Green Party in Europe as a starting point, there has been overwhelming popular objection to taxing something that a new tax on something that's otherwise free, the streets. Even people who were using mass transit object to it because they don't trust the government just putting on another burden. And so it's in every city, it's been a tough political lift. But in every case, after it's been adopted and tried, the public overwhelmingly sees the benefits and embraces it when it's done right. So this is truly a case where we're making sort of a quantum leap from 20th century mentality to how we have to operate to preserve our world and our species in the 21st century. And the way we're going to have to do that is with some proactive leadership. The mayor stepped out. Speaker Quinn stepped out. Most recently, Governor Patterson stepped out and said, okay, we know this isn't going to win a popularity contest, but it's the right thing to do. And in fact, every city, every place that's done this has been vindicated. In Stockholm, they did a six-month trial. They turned on the switch for congestion pricing. They turned it off. They went to a public referendum 2 months later, and the public overwhelmingly voted to bring it back. They loved it. Small business loved it because it saved them money. People who were pedestrians using the streets, people bicycling, bus ridership in London went up 37%. So every place this has been done, this is worldwide.
So how soon, Catherine? Not again during the Bloomberg administration, right?
I think that there's a continuity of effort here. The problems of funding mass transit are only going to increase. I think many of the ideas that took hold here, like the residential parking permits, are something neighborhoods have wanted for a long time that's part of this legislation. I think that there will be ongoing consistent pressure, and I'm hoping that this can be revisited even this year as we think about what we're going to do to fund mass transit.
Jonathan Capehart, put on your political analysis hat and tell me if that's pie in the sky.
I don't think it's pie in the sky. I think that as Kathy just said, and she likes to say that she's not she's one of the best political minds there is. She's terrific, but I do think that the problems of the city's, not problems, but the great thing about the city's growth and the increased energy needs and the increased sustainability issues will only force either the current mayor or the next mayor and certainly leaders around the state to address this issue. This conversation cannot stop. It has to keep going.
Well, the two of you are obviously on the same side of the policy question as we speak with Washington Post columnist and editorial board member Jonathan Capehart, who pretty recently moved down to D.C. to take this job, long a New Yorker, Daily News editorial board member, and did work for the Bloomberg administration in term one, and Catherine Wild, president and CEO of the Partnership for New York City, the business group that supported congestion pricing. We don't have much time. I don't know that we're going to get to phone calls, but 212-433-WNYC. If we do, you can always post a comment on our comments page. I want to do a little Bloomberg post-congestion pricing politics in a minute. But, Catherine, how much of a blow is this to immediate MTA expansion, to the extra express buses around the city that were promised as part of the deal, to MTA capital projects like the Second Avenue subway?
Well, in terms of the short-term projects, $500 million in immediate improvements and new stops on the Metro North and new express buses, it kills it. So it's a terrible blow, and it was something that we thought was going to provide some immediate support. And of course, the pressure of having a year to get all those improvements in place put a new kind of pressure on the MTA. I think it's also, in terms of the long-term capital plan, that's a much bigger issue. And the immediate congestion pricing revenues were not going to fill that entire gap. So that's a larger problem that obviously now is just bigger because we're going to lose $500 million a year that would have been there if we had congestion pricing.
I think I saw congestion pricing revenues as 15% of the projected MTA capital budget for the next fiscal year. Either of you could correct me if you know that to be wrong, but I think I saw it as right about 15%. So when 15% comes off that multi-billion dollar figure, does that mean anything in particular stops, like the Second Avenue subway, or does that mean everything slows down?
I think I'd put it a different way. I think that what having that new stream of revenues that was not controlled by the MTA, but was controlled by the Capital Program Review Board with City Council participation, legislative participation, that was a new handle for helping the MTA become more efficient, more responsive, more disciplined, to get some community priorities into the MTA capital agenda. The MTA is a longstanding bureaucracy. They've got their own set of priorities in the multi-billion category. We saw here that members of the State Assembly, like Barbara Clark, who was looking for handicapped access for 10 years out in her Middle Village Long Island Railroad station, that was something that she was fighting for. It didn't get into the capital plan. It should be there. And those are examples of what we have to do now to make sure that priorities of the neighborhoods and the districts that are not billion-dollar projects or even $100 million projects, but that they get into the MTA capital plan so people begin to see that we can have a more responsive MTA. And I think we've delayed that opportunity because I think we had a new handle with having a new source of revenues that were controlled by an elected body going into the MTA. I think that was an important concept that got lost in the shuffle here.
I'm going to get one caller on here, and it's Mark in Williamsburg, who has a good question for Jonathan, who is well-placed as a former New Yorker who is now in D.C., for this question. Mark, go.
Yeah, hi, Brian. No one's mentioning the policy initiative emanates from the Bush Department of Transportation. And what I understand that this is a move to privatize mass transit, to divest the federal government in mass transportation planning, to create a revenue stream that would be created vis-a-vis congestion pricing, and that the whole push is towards more privatization of the public commons.
Or at least decentralization from federal mass transit funding of any kind. Jonathan, did you talk to Transportation Secretary Peters or anyone else in the Bush administration about why they were so for this congestion pricing, that they would dangle this $354 million in front of us? I mean, on the face of it, you would think that a Republican tax-cutting administration would not like to see something that looks like a toll placed on roadways.
Right. No, I have not spoken to anyone in Secretary Peters' shop. And in fact, our paper just last week or the week before did a very good and big story about this move that Mark was just talking about how there are folks within the Bush administration who are pushing this sort of decentralization, privatization of the roadways within the Bush administration.
You know, I have talked with Secretary Peters and a lot of those people. I don't know. Oh, mm-hmm. Finish, Jonathan, and then
But what I was going to say was that the idea of congestion pricing and the fervor behind it, and Kathy, correct me if I'm wrong, pretty much started when people looked and saw what London did with its business core and saw how successful it was. And people started looking and thinking, hey, maybe this is something we should think about here. This isn't something that just popped up on the radar screen last year. Mm-hmm. This is something that's been looked at since at least 2000, 2001.
Yeah, but how is it, Catherine, ideologically consistent with the Bush administration?
Because this is going to market efficiencies. The Manhattan Institute also supported the congestion pricing proposal. It is to try and take the inefficiencies and the high costs out of a system that's dysfunctional. And that's what they were looking at, and that's sort of the ideological bent. It is not for the federal government to step out of the business. It's for government to quit funding unnecessary costs, to try and reduce the waste of both government and business on the cost of traffic congestion, which, as you know, we did a study demonstrating that in New York that amounts to $13 billion a year. So I think people, I know from Washington, and it became an angle to oppose oppose this on the basis that somehow this is a way for the Bush administration trying to sneak out of the transportation business. I mean, that may be on a Republican agenda. I don't know. It's certainly not on our agenda. It certainly doesn't represent any of the thinking in New York. We have fought as hard for federal transportation, mass transit funding, and for a formula that favors mass transit in federal law as anybody has. And we really think this is a misconstrued theory, that this is kind of paranoia at the utmost.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're almost out of time. Let me do a little Bloomberg politics with you, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Here's a post from our comments page that says, bad attitude led to the 2004 Republican convention dissident crackdown, and now this, scorn for elected reps who did not go along with his car tax, a two-bit legacy for such a talented, wealthy, and lucky man who I agree with on so many things, writes this listener, including the car tax, but it's that attitude.
Well, I don't know. So, I mean, I see how this person would think that Michael Bloomberg has a bad attitude. I would turn it around and look at it this way, that Mayor Bloomberg has taken on a lot of issues and policies that, you know, require enormous political capital, and doing so not because he's looking for any kind of pat on the back, but because he sees these things as something that will benefit the city long after he's gone.
What does this do to Mayor Bloomberg politically? How many bridges did he burn here or fail to build? And what does it mean going forward? He's only got this year and next in office. Is he suddenly something of a lame duck?
I'm not going to go so far as to say he's a lame duck. I mean, yeah, he's term limited. It's not clear what his political future will be. But I think that Within the mayor's shop, there is this view that, you know, we've got 600 some odd days left, and we're going to keep working as if, you know, this is day one. And I think that's the beauty of having a mayor who doesn't need the job, doesn't need to work, but is doing it because he wants to leave the city better than he got it. And coming into office in the aftermath of 9/11, that was a pretty tall order when he came in. And so I think, you know, eventually the lame duck status will hit him, but I think he and New Yorkers will be able to look back on his two terms as mayor
as being pretty
damn good.
And again, we'll say full disclosure, you did work for him in term one, but what about Governor Bloomberg? Any less likely now? I know he's never expressed an interest, but especially after the demise of Eliot Spitzer, people are speculating all over the place, but now he's got the whole legislature saying, oh, this guy.
No way. Oh, come on. Look, Mayor Bloomberg, if you're listening, don't do it. Don't run for governor. I don't see it happening at all.
Free advice from Jonathan Capehart, from Mayor Bloomberg. Kathy Wild, you want to add any last thing on those questions?
Well, I'd just say that the mayor is an international figure in business who is respected around the world far and away more than any other American mayor. So I don't see him having any lame duck problem.
Catherine Wild, President and CEO of the Partnership for New York City. Jonathan Capehart, Washington Post columnist and editorial board member. Thanks so much to both of you for coming on.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be with you, Kathy.
Thank you. You too, John.